All right, so hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Raw Talks. Me and Simba today have a special guest, my shamanic teacher, shamanic practitioner teacher, Kevin V. Turner. Very welcome to our podcast. We're very happy that you wanted to join us.
Thank you, happy to be here.
Would you mind giving a short presentation of who you are?
Hi, I'm Kevin Turner. I'm the director for Asia for the Foundation for Shamanic Studies. I've been living in Asia for over 30 years, and I teach in 7 different countries in Asia.
Amazing.
And I teach all the core shamanism courses offered by the Foundation for Shamanic Studies, which was founded by Michael Harner about 40 years ago. And we are considered kind of the premier modern shamanic teaching organization in the world.
Amazing. And you were just here in Thailand. You were here in Chiang Mai where
That's right.
I attended the basic courses.
And Sarah was the best student.
We know that that's not true. So here's Kevin. He's also lying to us.
Flattery will get me everywhere.
Yes. No, that was one of the most extraordinary experiences on my healing journey. I mean, that was absolutely amazing. And that's also one of the reasons that you are here with us today, because we wanted to talk a little bit more about power soul retrieval, which is one of the practical exercises that I learned. I mean, that's what one of the
and
things
I'd
that
love to talk about soul retrieval.
Yes, that's what I felt. So go, stage is yours. Start talking.
Okay, well, there's a lot of misunderstanding about what soul retrieval is. First of all, we don't really lose our souls. Okay, so that's a bit of a misnomer, probably a mistranslation from early anthropologists when they would talk to shamans and the shaman would diagnose this person has lost soul. And they didn't really understand what that meant. But if you look at the soul in shamanic terms, we see consciousness and soul as a continuum, meaning that it is not just a thing that we can grab a hold of, but rather it is a field, a consciousness field. And so usually the consciousness field is centered on the body. When we do shamanic journeying, we voluntarily dissociate so that we can travel to other worlds, we can travel to other dimensions. But some portion of our awareness, of our consciousness, still remains with the body. Otherwise, our heart wouldn't keep beating and we wouldn't continue to breathe. We're all guaranteed one full out-of-body experience in this life at the end. So in shamanic journeying and out-of-body experiences, astral travel, it's all part of that continuum. So what happens, though, is in terms of involuntary dissociation, meaning not by choice, if a person has a shock, if a person has a trauma, or any time that we have an experience, an emotional experience where we are not ready to integrate that situation emotionally. In other words, we just can't handle it, that whatever that disappointment may be, or that shock or trauma, and it may not even seem to be a big deal to others, but it can be to that person. And when we're not ready for that, to feel that, we go numb. We call it shock. We call it, you know, dissociation. We say, I'm dispirited. I was so upset, I was beside myself. And that literally describes how the soul or your consciousness actually moves away from the body, because you don't want to feel that pain or that discomfort or whatever, or disappointment, whatever the case may be. Now, something big like a car accident or a beating and a robbery or something that's more extreme is obvious, or a battle where you have PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. Involuntary dissociation can be actually a safety mechanism. And so it's not all bad. It's just that we want to be able to be reassociated. We want to bring our consciousness back into the body to, so that we can be fully present, to be able to have power here in the here and now in the body. So unlike shamanic journeying, where we're journeying out somewhere, soul retrieval, soul portion retrieval, is bringing back those portions of consciousness that have scattered away throughout our life. Now, normally, if a person in an indigenous community that still has living shamanism, if a person has a shock, a trauma, or a disappointment of some kind, the shaman will do a soul portion retrieval within a few days. So the reintegration is pretty easy. However, in the modern world where we've mostly lost shamanic practice, that doesn't happen for months or years or decades later. So there's plenty of time for a person to kind of, well, be living their life at half power or half presence. And if you look really across the world today, you look at people, they're not very present. They're not here. They're not now. Most of it is because of soul loss, this involuntary dissociation. And so little pieces of their consciousness are spinning in a loop from past traumas or past disappointments. And they may even have pulled a little bit of the consciousness back, but they had to go to work on Monday, and they didn't have time to process the rest of it. And then they forget and life goes on. And then suddenly these little chips of 1% of consciousness, 2% of consciousness, a month later, another 1%, 2 years later, another 2%. And people even say words like, I've got to get myself together. And that is a perfect description of that scattered consciousness. And it doesn't always have to, again, it doesn't have to be a big dramatic soul loss. It doesn't have to be a surgery or a car accident or a broken heart or what. Those are the sort of common ones, but it can be very small disappointments or even what I call institutionalized soul loss, which is where a person has to go or feels they have to go to, a dead end job, and they're, which is drudgery, and you even hear people say, I don't want to be here. Well, in a sense, part of them is already moving away, and they become habitually dissociated. And they might even say, oh, I hate my life, and I hate this, I hate that. Well, because they don't want to be present and live in a very mechanized, dehumanized situation. And I would say that this is actually all over the world. I mean, when the Industrial Revolution came, we were all suddenly dissociated from the land, dissociated from natural living. Suddenly we're going to work in these concrete boxes, and we're on mass public transportation, and we're stuck in little concrete box houses. And so that's just a worldwide soul loss, not to mention our educational system. I mean, when children turn 4, 5, 6 years old, they're carted off to the programming centers. And they don't, usually most kids don't want to go. They want to play. They want to stay home. They want to go out in nature. And so education is a good thing, but how we do it is usually by force. And so kids want to daydream. They want to dissociate. And the teachers are really kind of getting after them for dissociating and daydreaming and not paying attention. And that makes them want to dissociate even more. And so this is a healing that is, I feel, that is the most needed around the world and has been almost entirely lost. However, there are now many therapies, modern therapies, and if you get a skilled therapist, they can talk those, especially a talking therapist anyway, can talk those soul portions or those spinning loops of consciousness in the past, can bring them back very slowly, usually takes many sessions, can be very expensive, whereas a shaman can go immediately look for the lost soul consciousness portions and bring them right back, boom, 15 minutes. So you see, shamanism not only saves time, but saves money.
Okay, so I'm laughing because I don't know how many times we heard that during the... only, yeah, I'm not gonna, no, that was nothing.
Well, you know, shamans didn't invent psychology because they didn't need it. They had living shamanism, so they didn't need philosophy, they didn't need psychology, they were living and operating in spiritual realities firsthand. Mm. So they didn't need PhDs in divinity. I always laugh a little bit about that. I'm sorry, you know. PhD in divinity. Wow, you got to study hard in the library for that. Yeah, all the saints and sages studied hard for their PhDs in divinity, right?
The lifelong school of divinity.
Yes.
Yeah. Would you say there's any positive benefits with dissociation? Of course, you mentioned already that voluntary use states in the body.
It can be a safety mechanism. For example, let's say you're a soldier. You're in a firefight. Bullets are flying. Bombs are going off. Your friends are dying around you. There's extreme fear. There's hatred. There's distress. And then your friends die right there. But the firefight is going on. Do you have time to cry about it?
No.
You don't have time to cry about it. So you dissociate your grief. You say, I'll deal with that later. I've got to return fire. I've got to see who's wounded, how to get to safety. Do we retreat? Do we attack? What do we, you know? So you've got to have presence of mind to deal with the situation. After it's all over, you're back to base or whatever, then you can say, oh my God, my best friends were just killed. And then hopefully you can pull that dissociated grief back. Not the grief, sorry, the dissociated part of consciousness back, and then you can deal with it. However, that requires spiritual vitality, otherwise known as power in shamanism. And that by this, again, I mean spiritual vitality. You are filled with power. It's like energy, but it's something more than energy. It's actually a kind of spiritual intelligence. That is ethical, that is compassionate, that is evolutionary, that is healing. So it's not just energy. A lot of people talk about energy this and energy that. And it's a very vague word in English, frankly. I mean, Chinese and Japanese have 20 or 30 different words for what we call energy. And Sanskrit has many as well. I mean, prana, chi, and ki. They'll talk about many kinds of things. But in English, energy, we don't really use that word in shamanism because it's just neutral. For example, electricity is energy, but it can be used for good or bad. If I turn on the lights and I read a book, I say it's good. But if I stick my finger in the light socket and I have extreme pain, then I say it's bad. Well, that's just because it's neutral. But when I'm talking about spiritual vitality, I'm talking about that ethical, evolutionary, healing, compassionate energy. So shamans are always seeking to be power filled in order to do their healing, in order to do their service, their divinations for their communities.
That's interesting, with power filled instead of powerful.
Either way, full of power, powerful. Again, it's not about power over others.
No,
that would be a different kind of meaning. So what happens, though, is that people's personal powers dips very low because they go their entire life losing these little portions of consciousness or portions of soul, which is another way to say it. And this, for our purposes today, I'm really speaking about soul and consciousness as the same meaning in this case. Many shamanic cultures will have aspects of soul. They'll talk about an astral soul, a causal soul, an etheric soul, or talk about sheaths. But just to keep things simple, I'm talking about the part of the soul that dissociates. And in other words, the easiest way to think of it is consciousness. Mm. Yeah, it can be something very simple. You know, I so much want some ice cream and I'm thinking of my favorite ice cream shop and I'm racing there and it closes in 5 minutes and I just get there 2 minutes late and I'm just so disappointed. I could taste the ice cream in my mouth and I have just a little dissociation, you know, like, God, I don't want to feel that disappointment. And someone says, well, are you okay? And I say, yes, I'm fine. You know, well, I'm not really fine. But I say, yes, I'm fine. Well, actually denying our own traumas doesn't help, actually. In fact, it keeps the portion dissociated.
Yeah, so what you're saying is that it can be small and big events, but the fact, so the dissociation is a safety mechanism for us, but it happens that's on right. many different levels. And when it's not reintegrated, which means that you didn't have the time or ability or awareness enough to process that, to allow the body to basically become grounded and safe again and process and just allow everything to settle down, you know, come back to yourself, So when we don't do that, we turn it off, we don't connect, we don't want to feel whatever we were feeling, and we just move on, basically.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. And in the modern world, we have people doing this for 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
Until finally, they're just not even there anymore. You just see, I mean, there's only half a person or half of a soul or half of their consciousness is actually in their body. Mm. It's something that is recognized among many therapists, but they don't know how to describe it exactly.
Yep.
In shamanic terms anyway. And I just think that the shamans were very aware of this thousands of years ago, and they did it immediately, or at least as soon as possible. There's so many things to talk about here. I mean, in terms of, for example, if you get a phone call and they say, okay, someone very close to you has died, someone in your immediate family has died. So most people go into kind of a shock and they just go numb for a little while. But actually, again, that kind of dissociating that grief, it can be a positive thing because, okay, I've got to get flights, I've got to get funeral arrangements, I've got to take care of all these things, we've got to talk to the lawyers, we've got to clean out the house. There's all these things to do, especially if it's somebody close to you. If it's somebody distant, it's less of a big deal. You don't have much responsibility involved. So again, that can be a positive thing. Also, if you are, let's say you are being beaten, you are being raped, you're having extreme trauma happening to your physical body, it's a positive thing to dissociate. So many victims of violence will say, I didn't feel anything. I was watching from the corner of the room. Well, that's kind of extreme dissociation. But in that case, it actually was helpful, especially if they couldn't do anything about it. Now, you could have a different situation. Let's say you have two soldiers go into battle. Exact same battle. They were there the same time, the same place, the same gunfire, bombs, stress, fear, anger, you know, distress, grief, all mixed together. One has PTSD, the other one doesn't. Why?
The inability to integrate in the moment. Or the ability to dissociate?
Well, one who did not have PTSD had enough personal vitality to be very present, to voluntarily dissociate what needed to be dissociated, but to keep enough presence to save their life and behave appropriately. So return fire, get the wounded, leave the dead, you know, retreat, whatever the case may be. Whereas another person whose personal power or their vitality is down, maybe they had a lot of soul loss even before that, they just freak out and don't know what to do. and they're just cowering in the corner. So you can say, well, okay, you know, they're not functioning well. And so it has nothing to do with judging the person. It just depends on that personal vitality, that life vitality, to be able to be present even in very stressful circumstances. Now, if you take a child, for example, who is totally brutalized and there's nothing they can do, you know, there's some adult who they cannot defeat or escape, then a dissociation may be the only option for them. And so eventually we need to bring back not the trauma, but to bring back the good portion that left because of the trauma. And so shamanism, in a sense, is just very direct. There may be some vague residue of the emotional situation from the past, but usually clients will just feel more whole, more present, more together, because they're older, they're stronger, they're no longer in that situation. The traumatic event was probably months or years ago, and so they're able to bring it home. So we bring back the soul consciousness that dissociated, not the trauma. Now, there are other therapies which say, okay, you have to regress to some previous time, and you've got to scream, and you've got to cry, and you've got to beat pillows, and you've got to, you know, kill the perpetrator or whatever. That's another therapy style. Shamans just didn't do that one. They just brought the conscious, just brought the good stuff back. Yeah. In fact, we don't tell the story anymore. We used to. We did for a while. Traditional shamans don't. They don't come back and say, okay, I brought back the soul portion that dissociated because of such and such trauma. We never found that to be helpful, even if it sounds amazing, like, wow, how did the shaman know that I was, you know, hit by a car while riding my bicycle when I was 11 years old? That's amazing, you know, and I didn't tell them that. Well, yes, you know, those, we can tell lots of amazing stories, but the stories actually become distractions. First of all, they can be a little bit inaccurate because the shaman misinterpreted some of the information, and the client might start wondering, like, well, I was riding a red bicycle, not a blue one, you know, but I was 11. I mean, you know, this very small parts of the information may be inaccurate, but also the client can be ruminate on that story and possibly re-traumatize themselves by ruminating about that. So we just bring the soul portions back and reintegrate.
So who would you say this is good for, this kind of practices? I mean, both to receive as a receiver, but, you know, who becomes a, I don't know the name now, I want to say the wrong name, but who becomes
to be a shamanic practitioner, you do need training. So this is not something that you would do in just one afternoon. It sometimes happens. I mean, if someone is very naturally talented, the spirits might teach them directly. But essentially, one has to learn shamanic journeying first. One has to make friends, make allies with the all-compassionate helping spirits, the transcendent helping spirits. We can call them angels, we can call them other things, but they are ones who are not in this world anymore. They have graduated from this middle world that we're in, and they know it's tough here. So they're very naturally compassionate to us. So we learn to journey. And then we help them do their compassionate work here, and they help us do the compassionate work here. So it's a joint venture. It's not, the shamans don't really work for the spirits, and the spirits don't work for us. We work together. And so you got to learn to journey. You have to make your spiritual allies, and then you can go find soul portions for a client. So, and that requires some training, but it can be done. I mean, Sarah did it in 8 days.
Yeah, I did.
Which is about as fast as we can do it.
Yeah.
Actually, if somebody says, I can teach you how to do soul retrieval in 3 hours, maybe they can talk about it, but that's not enough time to practice. And you need to have the larger picture of what's going on.
How did you get into this work, if you don't mind me asking? What brought you to this field?
I'm not exactly sure. I was shamanically journeying since I was 4 years old. But I didn't know what it was at the time. We could call it astral travel. We could call it out-of-body experience. And until I was probably 6 or 7, I couldn't tell the difference between lucid dreams, out-of-body experiences, astral travel, or just dreams. And I think most children cannot tell the difference. It's all just mixed together. And so in my deep sleep, I was journeying around the house, going around the neighborhood, even playing with other children in the houses at midnight. And they were playing also with me. But they, around probably the age of 7, they suddenly didn't remember anymore. But I did, and I don't know why I did. I suspect that I've probably been working on this for a long time. So in different systems, you could say I had developed an organ of spiritual organ of perception so that I was able to retain those memories. So when I learned shamanic journeying, it was just as natural as what I had always been doing. And I was also a trainer at the Monroe Institute for 20 years. So that's where we teach basically middle world journeying, but later we also go into the transcendent world journeying.
And what I mean, it's a big process, I guess. I mean, you can't cover that in a topic like this, but like, is that like a wakeful state, would you say? Because you talked a little bit about you being asleep now and that you were kind of daydreaming, if I got it right, that you were in what we call a wakeful state and still going somewhere else.
When I was a child, no, it was in deep sleep.
Okay.
But I remembered. And in fact, I would say all of us do middle world journeying in our deep sleep. But most of us don't remember. For some reason, I retained those memories. I'm assuming it's because I worked on this for probably many incarnations. I don't know exactly. So everybody's at a different place. They'll learn shamanic journeying more or less quickly. It really depends on how quickly you can re-identify as being a soul and de-identifying as being a personality. Personality is very temporary and the soul is long-term. So the more one knows themselves as soul and the personality is just a kind of convenient masquerade for a while. It's useful in the middle world. Hi, how are you? That's such a nice personality you're wearing there. You know, I mean, so if one can re-identify and remember themselves as soul, they learn shamanism very, very quickly. But most of us have been sent off to modern Western education, which is all focused on the middle world personality and the material realities, and to forget everything about intuition and spirituality and set that aside. Then it gets harder. So then people have to pay money to come to my courses to remember what they always knew when they were 3 or 4 years old anyway. It's rather funny, but we can deprogram pretty quickly. I mean, to imagine what we did in 8 days in Chiang Mai last month, I mean, that's as condensed as it can possibly be. I don't know how we could make it any shorter.
No, I mean, you even said that you sometimes want to have more integration days. So it's like the course is a couple of days and then there's integration day. And some people say like, oh, why don't we squeeze it together? But it's very intense. It's very, very intense.
Yeah. So we had 2 days of class and then 1 day off and then 2 days of class and 1 day off. So it was really 11 days, but there were only 8 days of class with 3 break days. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty minimum. I mean, most people, those 3 break days are just...
A lot of energy in the break days. It was amazing. It was I didn't sleep much. Everything was like disrupted, but still functioning. And afterwards, I feel like I have expanded a lot. Like internal expansion is huge. Massive personal development. Remembering things, being able to work through very deep traumas. It's like the body can process things that I at that time dissociated. And yeah, it's I mean, we were doing so many things. I mean, we just didn't do the soul for our soul retrieval. That was just the grand finale that we were working ourselves up to. And what I also like is that it's just 100% practical. It's like, yeah, you talk, but it's like practice, like chop, chop, chop. I mean, so many things that we did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really have to thank Michael Harner because he essentially distilled 50 years of research and practice and the knowledge of hundreds, if not thousands, of different shamanic cultures he distilled into core shamanism. So we are really getting the essence of actually operating in spiritual realities. Now, religions can be wonderful, but they're mostly just talking about what the great shamans or sages or saints did, you know, centuries ago. And those priests don't really know. They're just, they have faith in the old saint who used to do the miracles. But we don't do those miracles anymore. Well, shamans do miracles every day. In fact, that is the definition of a shaman. Michael would ask two questions to determine if someone was a shaman. And number one was, do they journey to other worlds in an altered state of consciousness? And the second one is, do they perform miracles? If the answer is yes to both those questions, he says, okay, that person is a shaman.
Yeah. I mean, it's what I really liked. So I had a conversation with a client today where I explained, we were talking about working together with the different shamanic practices, and I explained what it's about, and I felt like I was sharing a little bit about the lineage, like the intention about it. And what I really appreciate and enjoy and feel aligned with is that during this whole process that we were going through, that you always and repeatedly came back to the ethics, the compassion, that we only work with like supporting people, we don't interfere, we don't use any kind of manipulation, we don't do it to gain something for ourselves. It's completely an act of service, and like always coming back to this alignment with the heart and the compassion and being of service.
And permission.
Yes. Permission. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Dr. Harner really beat that into us from the beginning. And you know what? It's not just a moralistic finger shaking, be good, but it's actually to keep us out of trouble. Because if you follow shamanic ethics of compassion, permission, service, then you don't get in trouble. The moment you go off that and you start doing things that you think are better for someone else, even if they don't, then you're going into sorcery or manipulation. And even if they're paying you to do that, well, no, you know, we just don't go there. And it's a great safety mechanism. So of course, shamanism is really about shamanic principles. It's not so much rules. It's certainly not a religion. You don't have to believe anything. In fact, it's extremely practical. So shamanism isn't really even an ism. An ism implies there's belief. For shamans, belief is irrelevant. Actually, the client doesn't have to believe anything. the shaman can still do the spiritual work and the client will feel the results. So the proof will be in the pudding. Now, there are can be some clients who are less sensitive. They may feel a little funny, or they might feel a little different, but they are unable to identify exactly why or how. Well, that's common. But a person who has even a little bit of emotional or spiritual sensitivity, they'll be able to tell something in my life has shifted, something has changed. And so eventually the shaman's reputation will build out of results. So when we go to a church or a temple or a mosque or something, nobody expects miracles, right? You're just going to hear some nice words, we'll do some singing, maybe we'll feel a little bit inspired. So, you know, religion is fine, it's just limited, whereas the shamans are doing what the founders of the religions were doing centuries ago. And they're still doing it, even now. Now, core shamanism is a little bit different than cultural shamanisms. And I just want to make a little distinction here. A cultural shamanism is the shamanism that is practiced in one cultural group, one tribe. So they have one lineage or maybe several lineages within a tribal group. And they have particular ways that they've been doing that possibly for centuries. But another tribal group will be doing it slightly differently. Another tribal group will be doing it slightly differently. They actually are doing quite similar things in terms of operating in non-ordinary reality or operating in spiritual worlds. It just looks different because they use different tools. They wear different costumes. They have different songs. They have different cosmologies because even though these spiritual realities are objective, from my point of view anyway, as a practitioner, they are experienced subjectively. So just in the same way that we can talk about the city of Chiang Mai, we can all agree there is a city called Chiang Mai, right? But we all go to Chiang Mai, we all have different experiences. So it's subjective. One person leaves Chiang Mai and says it's the most wonderful place ever, and another person has a less happy experience and says, oh, I'll never go back. You know, and yet that's an objective place. And yet here we have two totally different descriptions of one place. And in fact, I would say every single individual who goes to Chiang Mai will have a different description, a different idea, a different experience. It's the same thing with shamans all over the world. You can go to the Arctic, you can go to South America, you can go to Australia, you can go into Central Asia. All these shamans are talking about real objective spiritual realities, but they're using different words, they have a different cultural background, and they all have their own subjective experience. So we owe something of a debt to Mircea Eliade, the great Romanian professor of comparative religion, because he was not the first, but one of the first to really put it together that shamans around the world were doing very similar practices. And he wrote a huge fat book in French called Shamanism, Archaic Techniques of Ecstasy. And it was probably the first comprehensive survey from somebody who did not practice shamanism, but he was intuitive enough to realize, okay, these shamans are doing very similar things. So shamanic extraction or removing something from a client that does not belong, or a power or soul portion retrieval. Okay, that's also done. Or psychopomp work, which is healing for those who are deceased and did not move out of the middle world into the transcendent worlds. So he recognized these and he categorized these. Also the initiation procedures for new shamans. He began to see that actually very similar things are happening in the different cultures, even though the weather and the climate, and the traditions in those areas are so radically different. Actually, they were internally, those shamans were going through very similar experiences on their road to becoming one who knows. That's the meaning of shaman, is one who knows.
It Is there a difference between a shaman and a sage, would you say? I mean, there's so many different names you mentioned from religions, different people doing miracles.
Yes, there are many kinds of saints and fortune tellers and energy healers and psychics. But what is the distinctive feature of a shaman, at least in anthropological terms, is the shaman journeys to other worlds in an altered state of consciousness. So they usually use sound, either drums or rattles or click sticks or bells or singing, some way to move into a different state of consciousness in which they can work in the spiritual realms directly. And they usually journey out and come back, at least in the beginning. There are many kinds of ceremonialists. There are priests, there are healers, there are medicine men, medicine women who do wonderful work, but they don't journey. So in anthropology, at least, we wouldn't call them a shaman, but we might call them a different kind of term, a healer or something else. Again, and the miracles, yeah. So journey to other worlds in an altered state of consciousness, and they perform miracles. We would call that a shaman. Now, of course, the word shaman came from Central Asia and really applies very exactly to those practitioners. But there are many kinds of shamans, and some shamans are very similar to channelers. Other shamans are close to possession mediums. You know, other other shamans do more divination. In Mexico, shamans, for example, specialize in doing one kind of shamanism or one aspect of shamanism. So if you want to go get shamanic healing, often you have to go to two or three different ones because they all specialize. It's wonderful variety. It's amazing. And so it's not this one size fits all kind of thing like the so-called great religions just kind of churn out these priesthoods where everybody's been, you know, kind of programmed like a block of wood, you know, to regurgitate the story of what the great shamans did long ago, you know. But then, of course, our shamans are better than their shamans over there, you know. I mean, then that's a middle world perspective. We are in the middle world, also known as the confused world or the pain world or samsara, the world of illusion.
Yeah, all of this, like really connecting to all of this and allowing that expansion inside really helped me to navigate this world in a very, very different way.
Yes, I really have to thank Michael because he has given us a framework to work within. And he died 4 years ago, but he would be the first to say, I don't know everything. You know, this is what we have found so far. But wonderful thing is he gave us an overview and a structure to work within that is highly practical. Now, why it's that way, like some people will say, well, why is there an upper world, a lower world, and a middle world? Well, that's like saying, why are we here at all? You know, why is any of this happening? Why did the Big Bang happen? I mean, there's no answer that we can give for that. You would have to ask the helping spirits. But shamanism is also called the science of spirits. And so that sounds a little spooky to some people, and they'll say, wow, what do you mean science of spirits? Oh my gosh, that sounds spooky. Well, shamans are very humble. They'll say, I don't know anything, my spirits know. I'm not going to do the healing, my spirits will do the healing. Well, people are automatically suspicious, like, oh my gosh, you know, the spirits are going to do the healing through you. Well, at the foundation and in core shamanism, we only work with spirits from the transcendent realm. So we can call them angels, we can call them Buddhas, we can call them deities, we can call them many different names. But this is normal. And if you look at the esoteric aspects or the esoteric sects that are within the great religions, they will always talk about a hierarchy of spirits. So there's angels, there's archangels, there's archai, there's seraphim, all these levels of angels. The priests don't talk about that much at church on Sunday, but if you really go in deeply, you start to find out that, well, wait a minute, angels don't all just look like babies floating around with wings, you know. I mean, there's obviously some kind of differences here, you know, and like, well, what's the relationship between Archangel Michael and Jesus? I mean, where, well, wait a minute, you know, I mean, how does this work? Well, shamans would go meet those beings and those consciousness directly rather than just hear about it on Sunday morning. Or actually, you don't even hear about it on Sunday morning. If you ask a priest, well, you know, who's higher, Archangel Michael or Jesus? You know, I mean, you know, they'd be scratching their head and say, I'll get back to you on that, you know. Well, those hierarchies of spirits are exactly who the shamans work with. They have different names in different cultures. My specialty has been Mongolian shamanism and Nepalese shamanism, but I've also studied the shamanism in many different countries. You know, they all have these hierarchies of spirits that they work with. Now, the spirits who are more dodgy are the middle world spirits. And Michael has given us a wonderful term for these middle world spirits, and that is ethnocentric spirits, which means those spirits that have remained here in the middle world, and they are ethnocentric in the sense that they are only interested in helping their group, their clan, their family, their ethnic group or linguistic group or racial or national group. And they're not compassionate to the others. So they have a limited point of view. And the reason they have a limited point of view is because after they died, they remained in the middle world. Now, those spirits, you can get to do things that are less ethical, less compassionate. We don't work with those spirits, but many indigenous shamans do. They work with, they'll call ancestor spirits. Some ancestor spirits are in the transcendent realms. Some are right here in the middle world, which means that they can be enlisted or employed to do things that are not compassionate or not ethical or not in the largest point of view for everyone. So anyway, we don't work with those spirits. So, but it is a reality. They do exist.
I mean, we're not going to go on a sidetrack on this, but I just want to make a point of we're not all also not using any plant medicines.
No, in core shamanism, we don't. Even though Dr. Harner got his start that way, we use sonic driving. Better than 90% of the shamans around the world all use sonic driving. In other words, sound. And sound works beautifully because we can use sound voluntarily in our own way, either a drum beat, and we can change our brainwave patterns to perceive non-ordinary reality, other dimensions, other worlds directly. So we don't really need to drink something, and because then it's the drug that takes over the experience.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that there's nothing to be learned from that. I also was in South America. I've also engaged in entheogenic explorations. I'll say I learned something from all of them, but they actually become a detractor, and they can even hold people in the middle world to a high degree, even though they may be perceiving non-ordinary reality in the middle world. It doesn't make people necessarily more ethical or more compassionate. And in fact, Dr. Harner came to the conclusion that most Amazonian shamanism is all middle world shamanism, that almost none of the shamans are journeying to the upper or the lower worlds, which are considered the transcendent worlds. They're in the middle world, which means that they can fly out of their body and go do harm to other tribes, because they're competing in the middle world. And so, you know, it becomes a shaman eat shaman world, you know, in that case. And unfortunately, ayahuasca, you know, if that is assisting, for example, two tribes, that they'll drink ayahuasca and they'll go out of their body and try to kill each other. Now you have to think about what is the spirit of ayahuasca that's going to assist in that. You know, the transcendent spirits from the upper and lower world, they won't have anything to do with it. They would never support a shaman to go try to kill somebody. But ayahuasca does. So then you got to ask, well, I would say, in my view, the ayahuasca spirit would be a middle world spirit. So it doesn't mean that you can't learn something. And it doesn't mean you can't get healing. In fact, you can get healing and good divination from middle world spirits. You can send your spirits off to spy and say, hey, get me information about somebody. And they bring it back. As long as you pay them a little bit of chicken blood and a little bit of vodka on the altar.
Yeah.
But we don't teach that. We don't recommend it. We don't practice that. But it's real.
Yeah.
How does one start safely, would you say, if someone is hearing this and feel a calling to start exploring these sites in their wild? How would you start safely?
Good. That's a very good question, Simba. Thank you. We journey immediately to the transcendent realms from the very first class, the very first day of class. So I think that's wonderful because, for example, at the Monroe Institute, we take 2 weeks to get into the transcendent realms. And yet, in the first day of our basic class, we journey into transcendent realms. And the second day, we go even further. And so we make our friends and allies in transcendent worlds immediately. So then you are protected. Now, some of us, myself included, like Robert Monroe, we got our start by middle world journeying, also called out-of-body experiences. So we were floating out of our bodies, usually when we're taking a nap or asleep. Sometimes in deep meditation, that can happen as well. It just means that some portion of our awareness is dissociating away from the body, so we're perceiving other things. We're not really leaving our body, just a large portion. Oh, let's see if I can get myself back in focus here.
Good timing on that conversation.
Yeah, there we are.
I was like, what?
When I talk about these things, sometimes the juice comes in, you know. but I mean, many of us encounter interesting characters in the middle world while we're traveling, and so did Robert Monroe. He bumbled along through his middle world journeys until he finally broke through to the transcendent realms, and then he made his, we can call them, angelic alliances in the transcendent realms. Then he was much more protected, but until then he was quite vulnerable in some ways. So that's why we start right out with journeying to the transcendent realms. We get our helping spirits. We come to know them. We can journey to them, and we can invite them then to come into the middle world to work with us. Mm. And we get power filled with spiritual vitality. When you're filled with spiritual vitality, other spirits, if they come and give you a hassle, you say, be gone, and they leave. So I never worry about that, never fear about that.
Beautiful.
Well, this is, I mean, shamanism is humanity's oldest expression of spirituality. It goes back at probably 800,000 years, but we have evidence at least at 70,000 years in Australia, 40,000 years in Central Asia. Of course, we cannot, you know, nobody left a document file from 40,000 years ago, but from archaeology, we can say that these people were probably practicing shamanism. I mean, people are buried with crystals in a very ritualistic way. With, you know, animal headgear and things. So we can say that they were probably practicing shamanism that far back. And the Australian Aboriginals say they have an unbroken tradition going back 70,000 years. That's pretty long. And the petroglyphs would suggest that. So in that sense, all the sort of new religions like you know, Christianity, Judaism, the Abrahamic religions, even Hinduism and Taoism. I mean, those are the new kids on the block. They're a few thousand years old, yes, but that's nothing compared to 10,000, 50,000, or 100,000 years of shamanic practice. But that's because shamans didn't need a religion. You know, shamans were just operating directly in spiritual realities for practical reasons. People got ill. They needed healing. You operated, you found the spiritual origin of an illness, if there was one, and you did what you could. In terms of divination, if the tribe needs to know where to hunt certain animals or where to find them, or why have they disappeared, where do we need to go to find them? The shaman does a divination. Oh, they went that way. Okay, well, we didn't expect that. They never went there before. They go there, they find the animals, they hunt, they eat, they survive. So shamanism was about survival. Had nothing to do with just believing in some kind of pie in the sky afterlife. If you're good, you'll be okay. That was not really the purpose. It was about life right here and right now, about survival. However, of course, shamans also did explore the afterlife. And so that's why every culture that anthropologists have ever investigated, all of them had a word for soul or spirit. Every single one of them. There's no such thing as a culture that doesn't have a term for soul. So that would lead one to believe that there must be something to the human being as well as animals. They also usually considered animals to also have a soul and a spirit, which is something most of the great religions don't address or don't want to talk about or don't consider at all. So shamans consider everything to be alive. Everything. So the stones, the rivers, the trees, they all have spirit. They all have soul. They're all part of the great dream.
Is that what it's called, this reality, like the great dream?
Depends on the culture. Every culture has a different cosmology. Australian Aboriginals in the central area talk about that there didn't used to be a middle world before, that the middle world was part of a transcendent realm. But we kind of double dreamed and densified a dream into the material reality, and then the middle world and the lower world separated. So the lower world remains the dream time, and the middle world is this sort of ordinary, confused world where we feel pain. If we get stuck, we feel pain. Now, a physicist can tell you, well, you don't have to react if you stick a needle in your arm. Yes, something is telling you that there's pain to your brain. You don't have to react to that, but we do. In other words, we're taking the dream very seriously. So another way to describe the middle world is the place where people take the dream too seriously. Yeah. And we're in. And this is what causes illness all around the world. It's always when we're taking the middle world too seriously, we make ourselves ill and unhappy. So that's part of the illusion, part of the story. Also makes it fun. Somebody once asked, I can't remember who it was. It was one of the great saints in India, or maybe it was a Tibetan Lama. Somebody said, you know, well, why did we enter into this illusory samsaric middle world? Why don't we just remember, you know, the ultimate spiritual realities and we can all be happy? And then he paused for a moment and he said, well, it thickens the plot. So it makes it something of an adventure. Anyway, the adventure of remembrance, adventure of remembering who we are.
That I like that. I'm going to write that down.
So when I feel like I've about had enough of this world, I just keep thinking, well, it's just a thickening of the plot.
I'm too dense. Okay.
All right. We've been. Yeah. Do you have another question, Zimba?
No, I was just wondering because this the partner institute that you represent is all over the world, so people can connect with you somehow. What's
The what? Sorry, Foundation for Shamanic Studies?
Yes, sorry, that's the
Oh,
one.
yes. www.shamanism-asia.com. Shamanism-asia.com, or look up Kevin B. Turner Shaman, something like that. It should come up first. I only teach in Asia, but this is a worldwide organization. So there's an FSS America, FSS South America, FSS Europe, FSS Asia. We don't have an FSS Africa yet, but maybe someday.
Amazing.
Someone will step up and take that role.
I think so. Actually, we have two South Africans actually coming to the next 3-year training program, which is starting in Bali soon. And but I teach a new one every year. We start a new one every year, and it's not 3 years long. It's 2 weeks every year for 3 years. So it's actually a 6-week advanced program that meets 2 weeks every year. So you don't have to quit your job or anything. You can just continue. You don't have to move to Bali or anything. Not necessary. Well, wonderful to talk with you both. I'm glad you're so interested. I'm always happy when healers and therapists are interested in shamanism because it's really the roots. I mean, it's kind of the root of it all. But I think the new therapies that are coming out, I think are wonderful because they're extensions of something that we've known for thousands of years, but we've become much more sophisticated, and we've had to because in our industrialized society, we're a lot sicker than we used to be.
Yeah,
So
definitely.
we need the more sophisticated therapies. But I'm an optimist. I think things are getting better. I think they will.
That I feel
For
so too.
sure. For sure.
Yeah, I feel that these practices will be a very beautiful integration of everything that we're already doing because we have this amazing space that we are able to hold a lot of space for people who are interested in healing and combining all the things that we're already doing is it's amazing. It
Oh,
really is amazing.
bravo. Bravo. I salute you both.
Yeah, I'm very happy about this. So thank you for sharing the knowledge, for devoting your life to this, and for showing up in our podcast.
A pleasure.
And don't be surprised if we have another invitation for you, if there's another topic that we would like to deep dive in that
Okay.
matches. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, thank you. All
All right.
right.
Thanks.
Thank you, and I'll see you next time.